Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
New Books and Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. Cleopatra has long been one of the most intriguing and misunderstood women in the world. Philosopher Blaise Pascal once commented, "Cleopatra's nose, had it been shorter, the whole face of the world would have changed." While she was indeed influential, our view of Cleopatra is often as sadly limited as Pascal's. We applaud the sex life of the last Egyptian queen, but we ignore her tenacity and political skill. Today I'm going to be speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stacey Schiff about her book, Cleopatra, which is now out in paperback. Hi, Stacey. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography today. I wonder if you could kick things off just by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I came to write biography through publishing, into which I went directly from college thinking it was the place I most wanted to be. It probably still is the place I most want to be. So when I graduated from Williams, I think I graduated on a Friday, and I started at Basic Books on a Monday, where I worked for a year. And then I went from there to Viking, and then from there to Simon & Schuster, which I left in 1990 to write my first book, which was the biography of Saint-Exupéry.
And then can you tell us a little bit about the other books that you wrote after that before you got to Cleopatra?
The first book was obviously this a straight life account of a pioneering author and aviator. And when I finished that book, I thought what I wanted to do was something along the same lines, but wildly different. So the idea of doing a family or a set of siblings or a couple was kind of what I was kicking around. And I had always been a Nabokov fanatic. So the Vera idea, the idea to write about Mrs. Nabokov or about the marriage of the Nabokovs, pretty much came out of that sense of wanting to write a book that was the same but different, wanting to see if you could explore a person's life through his relationship, wanting to see how the life and the work were intertwined, trying to disentangle a marriage to some extent. And I think that the idea of the Nabokovs being caught up in the entire cyclone of 20th century history was pretty appealing as well. And from there, I went backwards in time to the 18th century to write about Ben Franklin's years in France, which are the 8 years, the American Revolution, and then the peace negotiation that follows, so the 8.5 years that Franklin spends abroad as a very old man, which is the greatest act of Franklin's life and I think the least understood, the least written about, and the most influential one. And also a very poignant one because he does the greatest service he can do for his country, arranging for the financing and the arms, which will win us our revolution, for which when he comes back he gets no thanks whatsoever, and it's a chapter on which we like to close the door since it implies that we didn't make our, and that we didn't gain our independence single-handedly, that the French actually were instrumental in gaining us our liberty. And from there I pause for a second to try to figure out how not to write a book about Cleopatra, which I spent probably 6 months or a year trying to resist because it seemed like such a wacky proposition at the time. And then I finally dove into it.
Okay, and we're going to dig into the story of Cleopatra in just a second. But first, I'd like to establish what she looked like, which is kind of a superficial point, but I think it's an important one, given that in most people's minds, she is Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, and I figure that, you know, years after this book is published, she will still be Elizabeth Taylor. I feel like that's an indelible image. And I did feel when I started that book as if, and as I say, it was a wacky proposition, partly because you're up against so much well-established, you know, well-encrusted mythology. You know, you're up against Shakespeare, Dryden, and Shaw, and then you're up against Elizabeth Taylor. That's a pretty hard, you know, it's a pretty obdurate mass to have to work through. We know very little about what she looked like, except what Cleopatra looked like, except what is on coins. And those are the only images we can really accept as authentic. There are, obviously, busts, but none of the busts has ever been entirely 100% authenticated. And many museums which hold Hellenistic busts of women whose hair was worn in hairstyles like Cleopatra's and who are wearing ribbons or diadems around their forehead, which would denote royalty, are thought to be Cleopatra, but none of them is necessarily a Cleopatra, and all of them have had their vogues and fallen in and out of favor. So the images on which we fall back are the coins that Cleopatra either had herself minted or were minted in territories she controlled. And on those coins, she looks very much like her predecessors, like the Ptolemies, her family. Sharp-nosed, sharp-featured, in fact, with a very prominent chin, sunken eyes, a high forehead, very Semitic in her looks, and possibly looks more sort of sharp-featured because she's trying to look authoritative and royal on the coins, possibly because the engraving at the time was obviously not hugely sophisticated, but the image is relatively consistent, extremely consistent from coin to coin, so it does seem to give us some sense of what she would have looked like, which was not a raging beauty and by no means Elizabeth Taylor. Mm-hmm.
So why did you pick Cleopatra, in spite of its being such a wacky proposition?
There were so many things that kind of came together. I had been writing a lot about women in power. This was just around the time of the 2008 election, or the lead up to the 2008 election. And I had been thinking a lot about women in power and how that had remained a stumbling block, how that had always been a stumbling block, and who were the women who managed to somehow either circumvent it or to make it work for them. I had long been looking for a subject or been thinking about subjects where the world changes, where there are those kind of hinge moments in history. And Cleopatra is a perfect example there because you can feel the sort of quivering ground underneath her when she comes to power. I mean, in retrospect anyway, hers is a reign that looks like it's a reprieve. It looks like her story is over before it begins. It's the end of a dynasty. It's the end of an era. With her death, the Hellenistic age ends. The Roman Empire begins. Christ will be born 30 years after Cleopatra dies. Egypt will lose its autonomy with her death and not regain it again until the 20th century. So many things are in flux, and you can feel the hunger spiritually in the air, religion-wise. It just was an incredibly fertile time. And so it was partly this idea of writing about a woman in power, partly the idea of being able to let some myths crumble, if not shatter, and it was probably the idea of grappling with a world which is so much in transition and therefore so rich, and so much written about. I mean, interestingly, we have so little on Cleopatra, but we have such a wealth of information about her world and about the first century B.C.
Were there any stumbling blocks?
I should say, by the way, say that there's also a great conflict, very resonant conflict there, between East and West. Mm-hmm. The East and West were defined differently in Cleopatra's day, obviously, than they are today, but, you know, at the time I was working on the book, or before I was working on the book, our lives were so saturated with Iran, Iraq, what was happening in the Mideast, that whole tension between the right-minded Republican West and the sort of dissolute, decadent East, which is very much the conflict of Cleopatra's day, except, of course, she typifies the occult East to the Roman mind. So there was a real sort of modern resonance in the story, too, which I'm sure I didn't escape completely.
Right. Were there any stumbling blocks in writing about someone who was so famous and so encrusted in this particular image, that she's kind of seen as this bloodthirsty sex pot? Were there any difficulties as you researched her and wrote about her that were a direct result of this image?
Well, yes, because you're constantly having to question, and you question every source. But in this case, you're trying to deconstruct a myth, and so you really, and you're at the mercy of subjects which you can't really question because they're 2,000 years old. So, and very hard to, I mean, generally, when I have done 20th century subjects, if I get something in an interview, I make sure that I have it from two different sources before I use it. Obviously, I couldn't do that kind of, I couldn't be quite so assiduous in checking things with this. So there's always a sense of having to take the sources never at face value, always with a certain grain of salt, sometimes with mountains of salt, or just ignore them completely. I didn't use for that reason, because I felt, for whatever reason, that the chronicler was writing to make a political point or writing to to grind an axe or writing to please an emperor or writing fiction. So there were terrific stories that I just plain couldn't use because I couldn't, it wasn't even that I couldn't corroborate them, it was that I couldn't even trust the chronicler. And a good example of those would be, for example, the story of Cleopatra and dissolving the pearl at the dinner with Mark Antony, where she's challenged to give the most expensive dinner in history, and she dissolves a pearl, which was sort of the diamond of the day, in wine. And that story had been told about previous sovereigns, about previous decadent rulers, well before Cleopatra. So clearly that was a recycled story that she just used to prove that someone was profligate. And so you can't really use it for Cleopatra. So there was that sense of always of having to keep the chroniclers in mind, remember when they were writing, for whom they were writing, and where they were coming from. And one of the things that didn't occur to me until late in the game was, because I was very aware of that with Cleopatra, but I was less aware until late in the game, that same combing through the motives had to take place with everyone in the book, particularly Mark Antony, whose story also comes down to us, like Cleopatra's, from his enemies, and that this image we have of the decadent, dissolute, infatuated Mark Antony, who is spending so much of his time drinking and partying with Cleopatra, is also the creation of the Romans who defeated him, his countrymen who defeat him. So that there, too, I had to, or I should have been, reading the sources very carefully and very skeptically.
God, that sounds really difficult.
It was maybe a year into, I said this before, it was maybe a year into the research, or a year and a half into the research, where I realized that I had to do sort of a crash course in who each of the men was who writes her story. Not just what century was he writing in, but, you know, whom was Suetonius writing for, whom was Apion writing for, whom was Lucan writing for, and who were each of these men. And, you know, it was a mini biography in a way, because it was, you know, what the agendas were and where this person was coming from. When Athenaeus writes on Egypt, he's Egyptian, he's seen Egypt. But when Lucan does, he's never set eyes on Egypt. So there was always that sense of having to know what even the geography of those lives had been.
So which sources were particularly helpful to you in fleshing out the story of Cleopatra?
Well, I generally would go back to Plutarch for several reasons. First of all, he's Greek by culture. And second of all, although he's writing moral history or history that is meant to hold up a moral example of some kind, he's not writing with any political agenda, as so many other people were. He's not writing propaganda. And he gets his stories of Cleopatra. They come to him over three generations, but he has eyewitness accounts of Cleopatra. So he would be the one person, I guess I would say, whom I took always at face value, although there are a few times, and Plutarch, for example, gives us the story of Cleopatra hearing that Mark Antony's wife is about to come visit, and she stages these elaborate crying fits, and she goes on a hunger strike, and she simpers, and she wails, and it seems a little overblown. It seems like, you know, it's typical sort of men writing off hysterical women kind of thing. So there are times where even Plutarch didn't quite pass the test with me. There are several accounts of Cleopatra's death, and Plutarch seems very overblown. So there are times where I questioned even him. But I would say certainly Plutarch, Dio, Apion, Suetonius, you know, it's hard because the people who really knew Cleopatra the best wrote almost nothing about her. There's one line in Caesar about Cleopatra, and it basically says she was a good, obedient female. That's all he says. And this is a man with whom she had a child, obviously. That the tutor to Cleopatra's children, Nicholas of Damascus, goes on to work for Herod, her arch rival. So his account can be discounted. There's very little from anyone. There's very little from any contemporary sources. In fact, almost everybody is writing later, and often much later, about her.
Were you surprised by the Cleopatra that emerged through your research, or did she turn out to be pretty much who you thought she was when you began writing about her?
You know, I generally begin with a, for better or worse, with an empty mind, with as few preconceived notions as I can. So I'm always surprised by what I find, because I'm never really sure. I mean, it's a terrifying thing to have to sort of keep yourself from coming to any early conclusions, but I tend to try to stay as ignorant in a funny way, as noncommittal as I can be for as long as I can be. So I didn't realize until I was some way into the project how shrewd she was. I mean, it took a number of times through certain stories for me to realize how incredibly strategic she is in her thinking. You can see that in the fallout in the Roman Civil Wars after the death of Caesar, where you see that she's not only manipulating people, but she's temporizing to great effect, and she's amazingly able to be patient at a time when most of us, I think, would have been precipitous in our action. And I only realized late in the game as well how cruel she could be, or how much she was able to play the sort of savage politics of the time. And I think I did go back to some extent and layer a little bit of that in about her, just the raw intelligence and the humor. The humor was obvious to me fairly early on. There's a passage in Plutarch about Mark Antony and Cleopatra out fishing that was probably the single passage that made me think the book was doable. And the sense of humor that is obvious, the cleverness and the sense of humor that are obvious in that passage, repeatedly show up in the life. So that is something that I was aware of, the sort of peal of her laughter, the velvetiness of her voice, I was aware of early on, but I think I came to appreciate it more and more as I worked. Her wealth came as a great surprise to me, I mean, just in terms of how she uses it, how out of proportion it is to the rest of the Mediterranean world, and how crucial it is to the kinds of politics that she plays.
Let's talk about her family. It was kind of a dramatic family life, which was typical of ancient monarchies, with a lot of infighting and ousting and murders. Can you talk a bit about her ancestors?
Yeah, she descends from, the Ptolemies are a sort of invented dynasty, you might say. The first of the Ptolemies is a general, a very enterprising general, and possibly cousin of Alexander the Great. And on the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, Ptolemy, as he's called, realizes that Egypt represents the jewel in the crown, basically, of Alexander's empire, and claims it for himself. And he establishes the Ptolemaic dynasty, so a foreign dynasty in Egypt, which until the day of Cleopatra is, in fact, a Greek-speaking, they're obviously Greek Macedonian, they are a Greek-speaking dynasty. Cleopatra, we're told, is the first of the Ptolemies. She's the last of the Ptolemies, but she's the first who will even bother to speak Egyptian, the language of the people over whom the Ptolemies rule. And these 300-ish years of Ptolemaic rule are distinguished by this raucous, really bloodthirsty infighting among relatives. The Ptolemies practice sibling marriage, so all of them are obviously related, and the closest threats to the threats to the throne, which are the most pressing, are obviously the closest relatives. So it makes for a very unusual family dynamic, to say the least. And in the centuries before Cleopatra, you have almost every combination of warring siblings, parent and child, brother and sister, mother and daughter. You have a husband who cuts up his child and delivers the body parts to his wife. You have every manner of savagery, essentially. And what distinguishes it in particular, other than the sanguine results, is that the women seem to be as every bit as meddlesome and bloodthirsty as the men. And interestingly, there are mothers, there are women who raise armies, there are women who head armies. Cleopatra herself will raise an army. There's huge involvement on the parts of the wives and the daughters in the Ptolemaic legacies. I guess the best way to put it would be that because the brother-sister marriage is what determines, is what holds the throne, the women actually are raised in value in a way they wouldn't have been in another dynasty. So the Ptolemaic princesses were enormously important in their own rights, and they used that sense of their own importance quite effectively. So in Cleopatra's immediate family, there are five siblings. The first is a sister who's murdered by the father after she's tried to usurp his throne. On the father's death, Cleopatra and her next youngest brother ascend to the throne. They're very quickly involved in a civil war, and he will die in the course of that civil war. And that's when Caesar enters the scene. And of the two remaining siblings, the brother Cleopatra allegedly will poison several years later. And the sister, who is equally shrewd and ambitious, who will try to usurp the throne from Cleopatra, is exiled to Ephesus in modern-day Turkey, and later, as a favorite of Cleopatra, Mark Antony, will see to it that she is murdered. So that was pretty much the way things fell out, even with the previous generations of Ptolemies. And if the story had played itself out naturally, Cleopatra obviously would have been, she manages obviously to escape all the problems with her own siblings, but in the normal course of events, she probably would have been done away with by one of her own children. So it's a pretty gruesome family history from beginning to end.
I want to come back to Caesar in just a second, but first of all, one of the things that really surprised me in the book was how Cleopatra is wicked smart. Can you discuss her education a bit? Because she spoke 9 languages, right?
Yes, Plutarch tells us that she speaks 9 languages. He gives us some of them. The one he leaves open-ended, he never mentions if she speaks Latin, which she, if she spoke, she must have spoken with some kind of accent. Greek would have been the language of the day, of court, of business, of international relations, certainly, and the language in which she would have been educated. And she would have known all the great Greek texts of the day. So Homer was the touchstone. And I guess I think the stress here is that the education that she had, I'm about to describe, was the same education that Caesar or Cicero or any well-educated, well-born Greek would have had, whether he had been born in Athens or Antioch or Rome or Alexandria. So it was a really universal elite education was one in the great Greek texts, which was to say Sophocles, Aeschylus, Euripides, Homer, Homer, and more Homer. She certainly would have known large parts of the Iliad and the Odyssey by heart. And would have been able to discourse with those men on the same subjects, quoting the same verses, and very much understanding the same wisdoms. Enormous emphasis on rhetoric, on declaiming properly, on being able to make a cogent and dramatic and convincing argument. It was interesting to me when I started to work on the book that although we have no education for Cleopatra, no childhood for Cleopatra, it would have been very clear how she was educated and what she would have read, and that yet no one had written about that before. If only because any well-born child anywhere in the Greek world would have succumbed to precisely this same rather grueling series of lessons and recitations and readings. One didn't read aloud, one was read to, which one didn't read privately, one was read to, which I thought was rather enchanting. But you could really fill in what was in her mind and what text she was familiar with, at least of what remains to us. Obviously, a great deal has been lost to us. But Homer was clearly the Bible, the compass, the touchstone of the day, and the Homeric deeds and geography would have been really clear to her, as would have been Egyptian history, which is something which is somewhat lost to us today. There would have been a great deal of Ptolemaic history. And one of the ironies, obviously, working in this on this particular book is that this was a paper-rich, book-heavy culture, Cleopatra's. And her reign would have been chronicled by court historians. There would have been an enormous amount of paper. There would have been great attestations to her deeds and those of her family. And yet, despite that richness of documentation in the time, we have nothing to work with today.
The story of how she met Caesar is a key part of the Cleopatra lore. Can you lay out the scene for us?
Sure. I mean, it happens not as it does in the Elizabeth Taylor version. And it was where I realized the book should start, because it's a Cleopatra who's so, is so foreign and so un-Elizabeth Taylorish to us. She, as I say, has ascended to the throne in conjunction with her brother. You had to have a male consort if you were a woman, or there had to be two, a male and a female pharaoh on the throne. And she and her brother are very soon at odds with each other. And he has the upper hand. She has been exiled. This is probably about 49 BC. Father dies in 51 BC. And has escaped Alexandria, which is where the brother is still holding court in the palace, and has raised a mercenary army of her own out on the eastern frontier of Egypt, just beyond the eastern frontier, in fact. And she's camped there with this mercenary army in the desert at the time when Caesar arrives in Alexandria. And Caesar is in the middle of his own civil war, sort of complicated intersection of two different civil wars. And it is at this point that she needs to basically make her way back to Alexandria to meet Caesar and to convince him that she is the Ptolemy to back, not her brother, who would have been the obvious choice because he had a larger army the favor of the people and a group of extremely canny advisors. So from what we can tell, she makes her way back to Alexandria surreptitiously, probably going up and down the Nile. And what we do know is that she is then, once she arrives in Alexandria, rowed under the palace walls in the harbor in a small boat, which is manned by a loyal Sicilian retainer named Apollodorus. And either during that trip or as she arrives at the under the palace walls at dusk, she slips into a huge leather sack, a kind of traveler sack that would have been used for large amounts of gold or a large portion of papyrus. And she aligns herself lengthwise in that bag, and Apollodorus slings it, ties it up at both ends and slings it over his shoulder and delivers her into her palace. And therefore she makes this incredibly dramatic return. We don't know if she jumps out of that bag before Caesar as in the Elizabeth Taylor version, but it's probably the case that her that this incredibly daring return made an impression on Caesar regardless of how she gets out of that bag. I mean, she would have had to make it past the river guards, past the police who patrol the river very well, over the barricades, and past her brother's army, which would have been guarding the frontier. So it was a pretty daring return.
So shortly after Caesar left Egypt, Cleopatra gave birth to Caesarion, their son, which also coincided with the rise of the Nile. And this kind of began her identification with the goddess Isis, correct?
Yes, I mean, it's really brilliant timing on her part. Other Ptolemaic women had used the Isis imagery. Isis was pretty much the preeminent goddess of the day. She's a sort of amalgam of all the fertility goddesses of Hera, of Aphrodite, of Demeter. There are images of Isis all over Egypt at this point. Obviously, it's a country with a great obsession with fertility and fecundity, since it is the breadbasket, largely of the Mediterranean. And it's a very powerful image. And Isis is the goddess of all kinds of things, of family relations, of returns, of love. And she, Cleopatra, either has the baby just at this crucial moment, or says she has the baby at this crucial moment. That is how the birth is billed. But it cements her reputation as a fertility goddess of some kind. And she does, we know, dress as Isis on ceremonial occasions thereafter. She may have beforehand, for all we know, but having had a child and having had a son, moreover, by an eminent Roman general, she does two things brilliantly. She cements this political alliance, and in the eyes of her people, she is able to pass herself off as the earthly incarnation of this goddess of fertility. And thereafter, and in fact, depicting herself, in fact, as such on walls of buildings. But she thereafter also has a brilliant consort, because she's now got the male pharaoh she needs with whom to share the throne, but he also happens to be a child. So a consort who is not going to in any way undermine her agenda, and who is also half Roman, which is even better. So she's really, it's the most extraordinary amount of mileage to have got out of motherhood, I must say.
After the birth, she went to Rome twice, right? And was there in the same city as Caesar's wife, which was a bit awkward, obviously.
It's very unclear if she makes one long trip, which would seem odd. It's dangerous always to be away from your country for a long period of time in these kind of restive days. Or she makes two shorter trips. And the two shorter trips seem more likely, especially because there are only certain times you can sail across the Mediterranean. So it's more likely, I think, that she makes two spring trips. But she's there, yes, with Caesarion, her son with Caesar, living in Caesar's villa in the hills while his wife lives across town. We know very little about how their relationship was conducted at the time, but we know that she couldn't have been in Rome had Caesar not invited her there. We don't know why she goes. It would have been in her best interest, obviously, to have made the trip. It would seem to be in his blindingly poor interest for her to have made the trip. And she's there when Caesar is murdered, which may have added, in fact, to the litany of complaints against him. It was interesting to me that in all of the lists of Caesar's misdeeds, which account for the assassination. He, you know, comports himself as a king. He takes too many honors on himself. He pays too much attention to military matters and too little to civic matters. He's become too lavish in his with honors. He's essentially behaving like an autocrat. No one ever mentions the fact that he's also consorting with the Queen of Egypt across town. And yet she so much ties into all of those damning statements about him. But it's interesting that she's just not there. And the only record we have, in fact, of her being in Rome are a few lines, like 4 or 5 lines in Cicero are all we have.
Can you talk a bit about the tensions between the Romans and Egypt? Because I know there was a lot of racial tension. It was the conflict between East and West. It was very interesting in the book, if you could talk about that a bit more.
It's a tension on several levels. It's a tension because you're talking about, oddly enough, an advanced intellectual civilization, which is to say Egypt at the time, and a much more primitive, much more militaristic culture on the other hand, which is obviously Rome. And, you know, when I say this was a moment of great transition, all of that's about to change, or at least all is about to change in terms of who is the more eminent civilization. Egypt at this point had inherited the mantle of Athens. Alexandria was the intellectual center of the world at the time, at Cleopatra's time, very much the opulent, gorgeous, gleaming, sophisticated fashion capital, the place you went to buy a book or hire a tutor. Rome is a provincial backwater. It's still a muddy, jerry-rigged city of dark, twisting streets. And as Cicero always said, there was no place to buy a book in Rome. And so you really have this sense of a city about to come into its own, Rome, looking both scornfully at Egyptian opulence and Egyptian the advanced civilization, which is Egypt, and yet enviously at that place. And, you know, that's a combination I think we all know well, that very very toxic mixture of scorn and envy. So on the one hand, there's a washing of hands of all that is Eastern and somehow corrupt. And on the other hand, there's a wholesale admiration of all of those advances. So many intellectual advances have been made in Egypt. When Caesar comes back from Egypt, he brings with him a whole catalog of things, a better calendar, the idea to run a census, the idea of founding a library, all these things which had existed in Egypt for years but which were new to Rome. So there's the tension there is really between old and new, Republican and despotic, Spartan and extremely lavish, and Cleopatra really... The Ptolemies really epitomize all that is opulent. It is their job to give the best parties and live in the greatest, most extraordinary of palaces, and the Romans are still at this point priding themselves on the simplicity of their lives. Of course, all of that will change, and within 100 years of Cleopatra's death, not only will the master craftsmen all have moved to Rome, but Rome will begin to become as opulent and decadent as had been Alexandria.
One of the things that really came across so well in the book was how Cleopatra manipulated that opulence to kind of shape her persona and the public's perception of her, which is really obvious in her journey into Tarsus to meet Mark Antony in 41 BC. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, that's the scene that Shakespeare steals wholesale from Plutarch, and for good reason. This is the fallout of the fight for Caesar's mantle after his death. And the two obvious candidates in the field at this point are Octavian, who ultimately defeated Cleopatra, and Mark Antony, who has taken control of the East. And she's been summoned repeatedly to meet Mark Antony, and she has very cannily resisted those summonses. But at this point, she can resist no longer. And so she, either on her own initiative or at the suggestion of Mark Antony's henchmen, decides to make this extraordinary appearance when she finally does go to call on Mark Antony in Tarsus, which is southern Turkey today. And she gets herself to the north side of the Mediterranean, where she dolls up some local ferry boats in the most extraordinary fashion, with purple sails and silver oars which clatter and glint in the sun. And she dresses herself as Aphrodite in golden robes and reclines on her ship, She's attired her maids as cupids and nymphs. She has an orchestra on board. Incense is spewing in great clouds into the air. And she very slowly, as this kind of divine apparition, makes her way up the river toward Tarsus to meet Mark Antony as this sort of goddess incarnate. And you know, you can imagine in a world that was as simple and as imagistically starved as was this one. I mean, there was no TV, but this was a pretty technicolor incarnation of things. What an impression she would have made! And it seems as if she purposefully made this procession quite slowly, so as to let the word arrive in advance of her that this Aphrodite had come to call on Mark Antony in Turkey. And in fact, that is how it is billed, is that she arrives as this goddess. Antony is deserted, or so Plutarch tells us. He's doing business in the marketplace, and the entire city has essentially emptied so that it can run out to witness the arrival of this extraordinary apparition. And poor Mark Antony is left alone on his tribune while everyone else has gone off to see this extraordinary visit.
I'm going to pull back a little bit and ask a big picture question, because if people want further details, they just need to read the book. But in Cleopatra, you write, she convinced her people that a twilight was a dawn, and with all of her might struggled to make it so. Can you expound upon this? And also, what do you view as her legacy?
Sure. I mean, when she comes to power, if you look at it from the 21st century, it's all, the jig is up. The Romans have, this is one of those moments where when you're living in history, you obviously have no perspective. But at this point, when she comes to power, the Romans have gobbled up almost the entire Eastern Mediterranean. She's the Ptolemies are the sole major power with any autonomy, and it's just a matter of time before Rome essentially takes over. How clear that would have been to her, is obviously a question of some debate, but her father had spent all of his life attempting to make peace with Rome, to hold Rome at bay, to pay Rome off. And of that she would have been completely aware. So that she's holding back the tide, the idea of holding back the tide was clearly the single most important thing on her agenda, maintaining her hold on an empire in an age where this colossal superpower was honing in on you, was surrounding you on all sides. So that's why I say there's she's trying to convince her people that times are as good as ever. She affects an intellectual renaissance in Alexandria. She's essentially trying to rescue an economy that is faltering, all at a time where the cloud of Rome is on the horizon, really more ominously than it had ever been. In terms of a legacy, the legacy, I suppose, is the anti-legacy. Is had Cleopatra survived, had Cleopatra not been defeated, the world would have looked entirely different. But she makes no lasting change in Egypt. She simply holds off the inevitable for a remarkable 22 years. Had she and Mark Antony not been defeated, all of Christian history would have fallen out differently.
Thank you so much for talking to us today about Cleopatra, which is now out in paperback. Any idea who you'll be writing about next?
I am working on a book about the Salem witch trials, with which I would welcome any help whatsoever. It's a far cry from Hellenistic Alexandria.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Stacey.
Thank you.
Stacey Schiff is the author of Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, as well as Saint-Exupéry, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America, which was winner of the George Washington Book Prize and the Ambassador Book Award. Her latest book, Cleopatra, is now out in paperback. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books and Biography. Thanks for listening.